The U.S. Constitution guarantees the right to bear arms. Does the Iowa Constitution need that guarantee too? River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. IPR's Joyce Russell and I get perspectives on the right to bear arms proposal from both sides of the aisle. Then we'll discuss proposed budget cuts to Iowa's judicial system and concerns that such cuts would lead to court closures and layoffs. Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, Mark Cady, warns that insufficient resources are beginning to, in his words, tear at the fabric of the mission of the courts. About it this hour. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today with Iowa Public Radio Statehouse correspondent Joyce Russell at the Statehouse Law Library. Mondays during the Iowa legislative session, we like to tackle issues our lawmakers are debating, proposals they're crafting, possibly new laws that will affect us all here in Iowa. Later in the hour, we'll talk with lawmakers and judicial experts about proposed budget cuts to Iowa's judicial system. But first, the Constitution. The federal Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, guarantees, of course, the right to bear arms. But does the Iowa Constitution need that, too? Joyce Russell, tell me, what have lawmakers been debating in Des Moines?
Well, there is a bill, a proposed constitutional amendment to add Second Amendment rights to the Iowa Constitution, in addition, as you just said, that are already there in the U.S. Constitution. There were bills filed in both the House and Senate. There have been other gun rights measures on the agenda this year, bills that were filed. That got more attention in the Senate. The constitutional amendment is the main gun rights initiative in the Iowa House this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Joyce, you and I will be talking with two lawmakers in just a few minutes, Republican Representative Matt Winchettle and Democratic Representative Liz Bennett, about this proposal. But first, political scientist Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa will explain what it would take to add or amend our state's constitution. He couldn't join us live, so I spoke with him earlier and began by asking him to take us through the process of changing the Iowa Constitution.
Well, I think, you know, for Iowa, doing a state constitutional amendment, the process is drawn out. It's slow. The two options available for amending the Iowa Constitution are not used that often. And, you know, if legislators are going to amend the Iowa Constitution, or if voters want to be involved in that process, there are two ways to do it. The first way is a constitutional convention, and this is a vote that's put to voters once every 10 years, and this started in 1970, so we've had a vote on it in 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000, and 2010, mm-hmm. And it's never been approved, but it's a question that's put on the ballot that says, shall there be a convention to revise the Constitution and amend the same? And Iowa voters have never gone for this. I think in part because there's some confusion about what actually would happen if it did go to a constitutional convention. We haven't had one for, you know, really, I think the last one was 1920 that the legislature called, but before that it was going all the way back to statehood, 1844, 1846. So that's, you know, that's there for voters, but it's a once every 10 years option. Mm-hmm. It could be on the ballot certainly in 2020 if this is still a salient issue. But the other option that's more regularly used is the one that starts in the legislature. And that's where the legislature, both the House and the Senate, by majority vote, would have to vote in favor of the proposed amendment. There would need to be an intervening election. And then the next General Assembly would need to also vote in both the House and the Senate, majority vote, in favor of the election. And then after that point, it would go to a vote of the voters, probably in the general election, in a November election.
So two successive assemblies have to vote on it.
Yep.
And then it has to go to the voters as well.
Right, and the key there is that it has to be two general assemblies, not just two straight consecutive legislative sessions. There needs to be an intervening election.
I see. Okay, so yeah, between 2017 and 2018, that would not count. You have to go from the session we're having right now, 2018, and then perhaps the 2019 session, because there will be the November elections.
Right, exactly, and then it would go to voters by November of 2019. And you think about what that's saying. I mean, that allows for some movement in public opinion. I think the best example goes back to, you know, some of the backlash with the same-sex marriage ruling in 2009. There was a big push for a constitutional amendment among some voters regarding same-sex marriage. Well, that process would have been drawn out into 2011, 2012, and by that point, you know, public opinion on same-sex marriage had changed dramatically. So,
right. The courts got in the way of that one, right?
Of
going through its full process.
Yes, exactly. So, I think this the way this is designed is to kind of slow, you know, any sort of immediate reaction to some particular policy, that you can't have that quick backlash to a particular policy. This draws that out and allows sort of for cooler heads to prevail.
Mm-hmm. Chris, talk a little bit about the relationship between a state's constitution, our state's constitution, and the U.S. Constitution, because, I mean, the higher authority is the U.S. Constitution. So what is the point of having something redundant in a state constitution like the right to keep and bear arms?
I think it would be a more symbolic statement. It wouldn't be anything where we could certainly override the U.S. Constitution. I think it's more of a symbolic statement by lawmakers to try to put that in the state's constitution. And again, I don't think there would be any sort of statutory power in doing so. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't increase the power of the state over the federal government. I think it's more just a symbolic policy statement by either members of the Iowa General Assembly or voters who want to sort of affirm the Second Amendment.
So Chris, mm-hmm. When we have proponents here, this could be seen, you say symbolic, but we could also say, in other words, this could be a purely political statement for the base of that particular legislator.
Oh, absolutely. It's a political statement. It's saying that, you know, you're standing up for gun rights and doing it in a way that, you know, you can position it, I guess, doing it in a way that is at the highest level that you see, that you think you can affect gun rights, right, by amending the Iowa Constitution. And again, there's no sort of statutory power behind it, but that's about as much power in terms of sort of symbolic statement that you can make.
So the idea here, Chris, as I understand it, is that proponents of this say, you know, it adds an extra layer of security, and perhaps with a look toward the future, this would help prevent, in their eyes, any future limitations, whatever they may be, on gun rights in Iowa. Can you see that argument?
Well, I think I can see that argument, and I think it would certainly complicate future discussions over gun rights and gun regulations. But, you know, I think in that scenario, if the U.S. Constitution has somehow reversed the Second Amendment...
Which is unthinkable.
Which it is, right, yeah. But I think if Iowa would somehow pass the Second Amendment, I think it would add it would add another layer of complexity. It would, you know, complicate public opinion around the issue more than anything. And it would get back to the same arguments that you see with the U.S. Constitution over what's the original intent, what's the intent of voters when they change the Constitution. I think it would complicate things more than anything.
Okay. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Earlier conversation I had with Chris, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking this half hour about the effort in the Iowa legislature to add the right to bear arms to the Iowa Constitution. Of course, it's already in our U.S. Constitution, the right to bear arms, so efforts here in Iowa to make that a state change in our Constitution as well. Ben Kiefer with Joyce Russell, IPR Statehouse correspondent. Joyce, there at the Statehouse Law Library. We also can enjoy the company of a couple lawmakers. Representative Matt Winchittle returns to our program, a Republican from Missouri Valley. Also important in this context, he's a trained gunsmith. Representative Winchittle, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me back.
And Representative Liz Bennett, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for the invitation.
Representative Winchell, let's start with you. Why is this necessary? Perhaps you'd like to react to what the political scientist Chris Larimer just said. We were sort of fishing around for reasons that, backers, and I know you're a backer of this, might want to add this to the Iowa Constitution.
Well, there's a couple of reasons that I believe this is important. Number one, Iowa is one of six states that is completely silent on protections for Second Amendment rights in our state constitution. I believe Iowans deserve the same opportunity that citizens of other states have to have in our state constitution protections for this individual fundamental right. I disagree that this is symbolic, and I also disagree that this is about politics. This is not about setting some policy statement saying, hey, we're good on Second Amendment issues. This is about pushing forward the proposal and allowing Iowans that final say if they were to ratify this on the ballot in 2020. I would also disagree with the terminology that we're trying to protect gun rights. Guns don't have rights. People have rights. Individuals have rights. The U.S. Supreme Court has said very clearly that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual fundamental right. Mm-hmm. And yes, the U.S. Constitution says that shall not be infringed. I believe the language that we're proposing in HJR 2009 is more modern-day language. If people want to look at it, they can get on the legislative website and view the language. And it adds another layer of protection for these individual rights that if a future legislature wanted to come in and try and roll back some of the advancements we've made in the past decade, they would have to have a higher hurdle to make sure that that met constitutional muster.
Wouldn't they, though, have to answer to the U.S. Constitution, which embeds that Second Amendment right? I guess the conversation that you had numerous objections, I understand that. But we're trying to understand a scenario in which the U.S. Constitution does not already protect people's gun rights.
Well, if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Heller v. D.C. and McDonald v. Chicago, the two landmark decisions from 2008 and 2010, the Supreme Court found and declared that the right to keep and bear arms was individual and fundamental. However, they did not lay out any type of judicial review framework. In this constitutional proposal, we say that any restrictions of this individual fundamental right shall be subject to strict scrutiny. That's the highest level of judicial review, where the government would have to show that they have narrowly tailored a restriction to meet a compelling government interest in order to, let's say, protect public safety. That adds that extra layer of protection for Iowans on a state level that the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly lay out and that the Supreme Court has, I would say, reluctantly been silent on.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liz Bennett, Democrat from Cedar Rapids, do you support this?
I have some very serious concerns about this piece of legislation. And there are a few things I think are important for the public to note. Number one, this is not the Second Amendment. States such as Alaska and Hawaii have actually added Second Amendment language to their constitutions, but they do not include the direction to the court to use strict scrutiny when looking at gun regulations. Now, like Representative Winchell, I also disagree that this would simply be symbolic. This absolutely would have an impact on Iowa policy, and it's reasonable to believe that we would see litigation on these laws in the Iowa courts, potentially all the way up to the Iowa Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So this strict scrutiny language is extreme. This would elevate carrying a gun to the same status as freedom of religion or freedom of speech. And we're concerned that it could make common sense regulations subject to the same rules as cases of racial or religious discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bennett, can you give us concrete examples of where your concerns lie, of a future instance where you would think that this would not serve us well? The wording here, any and all restrictions of this right shall be subject to strict scrutiny.
Absolutely. One of the things I have found interesting is looking at other states that have passed this language. So Louisiana is one such state. It's also, I think, important to recognize that of all of the other states that have language in their constitution regarding the right to keep and bear arms, only three have opted to go with this strict scrutiny language. And those are Louisiana, Missouri, and Alabama. So if Iowa passes this and adds this to our constitution, we will be in the company of Louisiana, Missouri, and Alabama. So for example, there was a case in Louisiana that went all the way to their Supreme Court, meaning that lower courts disagreed on the interpretation of the law. They had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to determine that a felon still under state supervision should not possess a firearm. A few years later, they had to go all the way to the Supreme Court again to determine that a felon convicted of unauthorized entry of an occupied dwelling, basically breaking and entering, could not carry a concealed weapon or possess firearms for 10 years from the completion of their parole or their duty to the state. So I think it's really important to notice that these things had to go all the way to their Supreme Court, even though this was a very reasonable law that specified that the limitation only applied to felony offenses having the actual or potential danger of harm to the general public. So I think the public here in Iowa needs to ask, do we need to enact something where we have to go all the way to the Supreme Court to figure out that a felon convicted of a dangerous felony shouldn't be carrying a firearm?
And in the end, then, those Supreme Court rulings did uphold those restrictions, right?
They did.
Mm-hmm. Representative Winchell, what about that example where this would be just hurdles, unnecessary hurdles, is I guess a shorthand that perhaps can sum that up?
To put it simply, I would say that back to where Representative Bennett first started, about elevating this right to other rights we have out there. Number one, this is a fundamental right, and therefore it already meets the threshold of having to have the highest level of judicial review. Every fundamental right that we have, the right of religion, the right to vote, right to interstate travel, all of those things have already been declared by the U.S. Supreme Court as needing that highest level of strict scrutiny to one degree or another. And when you're talking about depriving someone of that individual fundamental right, putting those questions before the court is doing exactly what we as citizens should be doing, asking the question, is that constitutional? I understand there are some concerns out there about how this proposed amendment might affect certain regulations we have in the books right now. I disagree that this would overturn anything. I believe that this merely puts a baseline out saying that we have made a lot of advancements on a state level, and if there are to be future restrictions, that they have to meet that compelling government interest and be narrowly tailored to protect the interests of the people or the public safety.
Let's go to
Representative Bennett. Do you agree with that? That Representative Winchell seems to be saying that whatever restrictions are on the books right now are safe, but that that this could affect future restrictions. First of all, am I representing what you just said accurately?
I believe that if you looked at the current regulations we have on the books, they would meet that standard. I'm not a judge, though, and I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't predict what the court may do. But in looking at what has happened in these other states, including Missouri and Louisiana, both states had cases go to their Supreme Court, as Representative Bennett said, multiple different questions before the court about felon possessing a firearm or overturning other restrictions they had. Both of those states upheld the current regulations because they were narrowly tailored and they did meet that compelling government interest.
And are you assured of that, Representative Bennett?
No, not necessarily. And it's true that we don't have a crystal ball as legislators, but I think we do have the responsibility to look down the road and look at other case studies of what could occur when we're enacting legislation. So some other questions that I think could come up would schools have the legal right to restrict the possession of and use of firearms on their property? What about daycare owners? What about hospitals? Would hospitals have the legal right to restrict the use of firearms on their property? What about a business owner who has a sincerely held religious objection to firearms on their property? A lot of other questions like that. And I think what we're doing is we're opening a can of worms where we're going to have to see things that a lot of people would find to be common sense regulations going all the way through our Supreme Court. Now, that's also important because I know that later you'll be talking on funding cuts to the judiciary. So in a time where our judiciary is already strapped, we're going to be opening the door to a lot more litigation.
Representative Winchell, you had something to say there?
Just very quickly, this proposal would in no way bridge the private-public property boundary line. If, as an individual business owner, someone wants to say, no firearms in my establishment, that is a private property right that this will not encroach upon. As far as the other areas that Representative Bennett listed, schools, hospitals, things of that nature, all of that is covered in state statute, and that is well established in 724.28 in the state code, where it says political subdivisions cannot put further restrictions on that the state doesn't already allow. This does not get into that question at all.
Representative Winchell, I wanted to ask, given the events of the last couple of weeks, the mass shooting in Florida, and the climate it's created, the national debate it has renewed over gun rights and gun legislation, how has that impacted your efforts here to add this right to bear arms to the Iowa Constitution? Has it changed those efforts, given you any other thoughts here, or changed the likelihood of starting this effort? In a long process of getting it into change.
I do not believe that it has stalled the efforts on this or hampered them. There are ongoing discussions about what we can do immediately right now on a state level to try and address some inadequacies that we have out there. Part of that discussion is the mental health problem. How are we identifying people that shouldn't have access to firearms, getting them the help they need before they commit some heinous act? And there's a lot of those discussions happening, but it has not affected the discussion on this proposal because, as we highlighted in the beginning, this is a long, drawn-out process. We would have to push it through this year and then again next year, and then voters would have the final say in 2020.
What is your view, Representative Winchell, of the nationwide student movement? What would you say, for instance, specifically to the leaders of that movement who want adults to take action and have more gun control legislation?
Thank you for being part of the conversation. We hear you loud and clear. We're looking at how we can address the issues that are prevalent in our society today without being reactive and putting an arbitrary restriction on an individual fundamental right. Again, we need to be looking at the bad actors that are out there, how to identify them, how to make sure that they're not having access to firearms so that they don't have the opportunity to commit these heinous acts.
Let's go to our phones if we can. Justin is not with us. It doesn't. Justin, are you there? Justin? No, he's not there. Okay. Let me ask you this then. What about the president talking about this just today? Is arming teachers the answer when we talk about having safer schools? Let me have you start, please, Representative Bennett.
Thanks for that question. I have a few things that I think we need to respond to here. First, I'd just like to say that, you know, I was a junior in high school when Columbine High School happened. I think we all remember that. And now I sit as a representative, and the students from a high school I represent, Washington High School in Cedar Rapids, are emailing me, tweeting me, and they are rising up in protest. When we talk about fundamental freedoms, I haven't heard too much conversation about a person's fundamental right to go to school without fear of being murdered. Now, the NRA, for example, is framing this as a mental health issue. Certainly, mental health does play a role in some mass shootings, but there's also a substantial body of research indicating that other factors such as anger, inability to express feelings, and certainly access to firearms that enable a person to kill a large number of people in a short amount of time are at hand in some of these shootings. So I do think we need to take a holistic look at what's going on here. Back to arming teachers. I think there are some significant concerns with that. It's interesting to me that that's coming up in the conversation in Iowa because just last year we had a debate on Chapter 20, you know, which is about employees, public employees having the option to participate in, you know, rules and regulations of their working environment. And it was made very clear by Republican members of the legislature that public employees such as teachers are not considered to be public safety employees. Okay. So it seems strange to me that just a year after strongly stating that teachers are not considered public safety employees, now we have the president and other people talking about arming teachers.
Okay, we have your point. Thank you. Respectfully, Representative Bennett, we have 30 seconds to have Representative Winchell respond, and then we've got to go to a break. Representative Winchell.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Again, we need to look at this in not a reactive standpoint, but what do we do moving forward?
Okay, but armed teachers, on that point.
I believe it's part of the discussion, but law already allows for school districts to allow people to carry on school grounds if they so choose. It's already in the law.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Matt Winchell and Representative Liz Bennett. Thank you both for stepping into the State House Law Library, and we'll hope to talk to you again on this program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll change topics and talk about the proposed budget cuts to Iowa's judicial system. Hope you'll stay tuned. Ben Kiefer with Joyce Russell. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the aftermath of the mass shootings, we often hear about the need for mental health diagnoses and treatment. What services are being provided in Iowa, and what are the future needs for caring for mental health here in the state? That'll be the topic tomorrow over the noon hour on River to River. Joining me today is Joyce Russell, our State House correspondent for Iowa Public Radio. And we're going to switch gears this half hour to talk about proposed budget cuts to Iowa's judicial system, concerns about the cuts leading to, I don't know, layoffs and other things. Joyce, bring us up to speed about what's been happening with these proposed budget cuts concerning the Iowa judiciary, because the larger context here is a big budget shortfall where they're looking for budget cuts in lots of places, right?
That's right, and a significant reduction was proposed in the Iowa Senate. That has now been scaled back to the same request that Governor Reynolds had proposed, but there are still concerns about cutting the court's budget mid-year. It would be the second year in a row that there were mid-year budget cuts to the judicial branch. There are already a number of vacant judgeships, and court advocates say that this is impeding the, you know, the effective activity of the courts. And so there is concern, even though this budget cut for the rest of this fiscal year has been scaled back, there is still concern about what that would do for court services.
Before we get to our lawmakers and a couple of other guests we have, let's hear Justice Katie, the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, talking about, I believe this is from his State of the Judiciary address back in January, about how budget cuts have led the court system to employing already, these are not the current ones, but past budget cuts, the court system employing 182 fewer people than authorized a year ago, a 10% in reduction workforce. Here's Justice Katie.
There are fewer judges, fewer court reporters, fewer case schedulers, and fewer juvenile court officers. It means there is a daily struggle to coordinate and deliver services. It means Iowans are losing access to justice. 2 years ago, I told you about our commitment that all cases would be timely tried on the date set for trial without delay. We have been forced to walk back from this pledge because we do not have enough people to do the work to keep it. So, the delays we were rapidly eliminating from the process of justice are returning and affecting your constituents who need our services to resolve their disputes. But that is not all. Today, Iowans who reside in rural areas are receiving fewer court services than Iowans in urban areas. Today, a freeze on new specialty courts exists. So the critical services provided by a specialty court in one county is not being provided in another county. And today, I am concerned all of this causes us to lose focus on the quality and the promise of justice. This is not what a process of justice should be.
Chief Justice Mark Cady of the Iowa Supreme Court joining us now. Steve Eckley, president of the Iowa State Bar Association. He's a litigation attorney. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
As Joyce just outlined, these cuts, proposed cuts, have been scaled back to $1.6 million pointed at the judicial branch. What do you see the impact and possible impact of such cuts? Also keeping in mind Chief Justice Cady's words there.
Well, I communicate regularly with attorneys in every county in Iowa. I'm the president right now of the Iowa State Bar Association. We have about 8,000 members all around the state. So we recognize the budget problems that the representatives are facing, but it's important for Iowans to understand the effects of cutting the judicial branch another $1.6 million over the next 4 months. As Chief Justice Katie said, the courts are already reeling from past cuts. At the beginning of the year, the judicial branch staffing was down about 10%. And because 96% of the court's budget goes to personnel costs, if the budget is cut, that means more cuts to the workforce. It's something that probably most folks in Iowa don't know, but there are almost 750,000 new cases filed each year in our district courts. Those are cases that are brought by Iowa citizens, Iowa businesses, and by our government agencies, including prosecutors bringing criminal charges. It's a huge volume of business. It affects directly or indirectly everyone in this state.
So how does the judicial branch, how do the courts then deal with reduced funding on this scale, 10% before and possibly 1.6 million more here? What happens when Iowans seek the services of courts in various ways?
Well, I'm not privy to the latest plans or strategies from the judicial branch, but in the past, we've had to close courthouse services in various courthouses around the state. We've had to have furlough days where courthouses were closed certain days of the week. Folks go without getting paid. They don't come to work, so we don't pay them. That's about the only way you can save significant dollars in a judicial budget that is so heavily geared to personnel costs. So that will happen again at some level. I can't tell you exactly what level that would be.
The State House Law Library, Joyce, we have Representative Gary Werthen with us, a Republican from Storm Lake, also chair of the Justice Systems Budget, and Senator Rob Hoge, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Happy to be on the show.
Let's have each of you weigh in on what stands now as a proposed $1.6 million cut from the judicial branch, given what you've heard. Representative Werthen, where do you stand?
Well, I'm glad we're back down to the $1.6 million amount that the governor recommended. We always struggle with these types of things, and we look back, and over the last 10 years, the judicial branch has fared fairly well in the state budget. As we've hit these little tougher times as far as reduced revenue growth, we've had to scale back. We're a percent or two shy of what the revenue growth was projected to be, and so we have to balance the budget. I'm in constant contact with Mr. Nuccio, the state court administrator, Chief Justice Katie, and their staffs, and I've been assured by them that at the $1.6 million level that there will be – people will see very – little reduction in services out in the country. They will be able to maintain services through the end of the fiscal year. Looking ahead to fiscal year 19, we're looking real hard at that and how we can buck up the judicial system and supply the services that the people of Iowa need.
Senator Hoge.
Well, obviously, I'm glad that the Senate Republicans backed off what was just a really reckless proposal of cutting $4.8 million with only 4 months left. And listeners may remember that was something that the court said if that happened, they'd have really no choice but to close roughly 30 courthouses. And I think what people need to recognize is the courts are already down employee-wise. It's 300 from the peak. We're down 100 over the last year. And the court system is labor-intensive. Now, there's also a difference between the types of courthouses we have around the state. In many rural communities, it's a very small office to begin with. So if you want to actually reduce significantly staffing, then that leads them, prompts them to close those courthouses. And that hurts because many ordinary Iowans are accessing the court system, whether it's as paying fines, child support, public safety matters, criminal matters, domestic abuse, mental health matters, being a witness in a case. We need to make sure that our courthouses are accessible to Iowans.
Let's have Scott Peters join us in this conversation, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Ben.
So talk about where Iowa finds itself in these fiscal problems and cutting courts budgets in this way. Is this unusual if we look at, for instance, other states?
I guess I'm not exactly sure how unusual it is. I mean, I think when states are facing fiscal shortages like Iowa, they'll frequently have to cut, different parts of the budget, including the courts. It's also worth keeping in mind, I think, that states have a lot of different ways they fund the courts. Iowa has more of a unified system in which funding is largely determined at the state level. Some states are more reliant upon local revenues to fund courts. Generally speaking, that's a stronger system, one like we use in Iowa, where we fund at the state level. It tends to provide more stable funding sources for the courts statewide, and tends to result in a better administration of justice.
Mm-hmm. So it's not taken together, Scott, together with this idea of a supermajority, the controversial proposal from the Senate Judiciary Committee that would require a supermajority of Iowa Supreme Court justices to declare any law unconstitutional. That's another Senate file up for debate now. Currently, what, 4 of 7 votes are needed in our state high court to declare something unconstitutional. This law would require 5. Taken together, one could draw the conclusion with court budget cuts that the legislature is sort of trying to weaken the budget or weaken the court system. Could one jump to that conclusion?
I would say a couple things about that. I think it's really important to keep when we talk about attempts to curb the courts, as we call it in political science. When we talk about court curbing attempts, these things aren't unique to Iowa. And so, like the bill introduced in the Senate to require a supermajority, there are hundreds of bills nationwide that are introduced at the state level by legislatures to in some way take action against states. One scholar, Megan Leonard from Illinois State University, she's done research on this nationwide at the state level. And so between 2008 and 2012, there were about 500 bills introduced in state legislatures to try to limit the powers of courts in some way. Sometimes they're trying to change the way judges are selected or retained in office. Often they're trying to change the ability of courts to rule on issues, including the ability to exercise judicial review. A decent number of those have been introduced in Iowa over the years. They tend to be introduced, they're far more likely to be introduced in states where the legislature is more conservative. Since 2012, the pace of introduction of these bills has increased pretty significantly. But they don't pass that often. Only about 2% of these proposals actually pass. So they seem to be used to indicate disagreement with the courts, dissatisfaction with the courts. They're being used to signal to constituents that these legislators are unhappy with the courts. And in some states, budget bills have also been used in the same way. Budget bills have been used to try to sort of penalize the courts.
Representative Worthen, are budget bills being used to penalize the courts in Iowa?
No, I think if you look over the last 10 years on a year-over-year basis, there's only been 2 cuts to the judicial branch budget. The first from 2009 to 2010, which was, I believe, the 10% across the board cut, and then again from 2016 to 2017. So, and in the interim, The average increase to the court to judicial branch was in a neighborhood of 3.5% a year, right around a little over $6 million a year. So I don't think that the budget is being used to try and dictate anything to the court. What I say to my caucus is that the budget is not the vehicle to do that. In Iowa, we have a system where judges are up for retention on a periodic basis. And if you have a problem with how a judge has been ruling or his demeanor or whatever, that's the occasion to take action on that particular judge. But no, I don't believe that we're using the budget to try and dictate anything to the court at this point.
And Senator Hoag, you come from a chamber where a much bigger cut was proposed to the courts. Is your chamber using the courts to send a message about court activism?
Yeah, well, obviously that's not something I supported, and I was very glad we were able to fend off the deeper cut, although I'm still worried about the current cut, because I do think it threatens judicial independence. I know that Representative Worthen talked about the 2009 and 10 cuts, but what happened there was Governor Culver, when he made the across-the-board cut, actually asked the court to volunteer to make a cut. And that's much different than what's happening now, where the legislature is passing a cut against the desires of the judicial branch. I think it is very important that we maintain an independent judiciary. And obviously you see it with the Senate file, and I understand there's not a House companion to it, but the Senate file to try to change the rules for how a court makes a decision. That's another threat to judicial independence, and it concerns me.
I wanted to have you react to more words of Chief Justice Cady. This minute or so of his speech from January on the importance of funding specialty courts, drug courts, mental health courts, how it saves money in the long run by avoiding incarceration for some Iowans. Perhaps Steve Eckley and others can comment, elaborate, give their views of Katie's words here from January.
Last year, Iowa's juvenile diversions programs diverted more than 10,000 children from the formal court system. These programs alone avoided more than $14 million in costs to other parts of the state budget. Family treatment courts served more than 300 families last year, generating a cost avoidance of more than $3.5 million in the human services budget. Other specialty courts avoided $4 million in costs. And these programs are all in addition to the $146 million the Iowa court system collects for the general fund each year. Last year, the total return on investment in your court system was more than $178 million. Your investment in the process of justice benefits all Iowans and taxpayers.
Chief Justice Mark Cady. Steve Eckley, perhaps you can comment on that, talking about our court system in terms of return on investment.
Gladly, thank you. So it's important to understand that the judicial branch receives only about 2.5% of the state general fund revenue. That 2.5% amounts to about, well, last year it was $175 million. And of that $175 million, as Chief Cady just indicated, about $150 million is returned to the general fund by the court system through collection of fees and fines and different court costs that go back into the state budget. Then that leaves about $25 million that the court doesn't directly return to the general fund, but it does return it. And even more than that, as the chief said, the estimate is that about $30 million in money is saved from other state agencies because of the specialty courts that the judicial branch operates. Those courts keep families and juveniles and substance abusers, folks with mental health problems, out of other state agencies where the cost would be greater. So, in effect, the judicial branch pays for itself between what it saves other state agencies and what it returns to the general fund, the judicial branch completely covers its own cost. And yet each year it has to go back and beg the legislature to give it the money it needs to serve Iowans in 99 counties.
We're just about out of time, but we want to move on to the next year's budget. And the court has asked for a 7.5%, or rather almost 8% increase next year, which would be way more than just about anybody is getting. They don't say that that would help them add any specialty courts. It does say that that would help them fill many of these vacant positions. Representative Worthen, what are their chances for getting that?
Well, I think, you know, a 7.5%, 8% increase is probably not in the books. I'm very hopeful that we can have an increase going into fiscal year 19 for the courts. I think we've laid the groundwork for that over the last couple of weeks when we set supplemental state aid for K through 12 schools. There was a lot of pressure to be a lot higher than 1%. But when we looked at the total budget, the stress that we've got, not only in the judicial branch, but in public safety and in the correction system, we need to adjust some priorities a little bit so that we can put some more money into those areas, at least cover their salary annualization and hopefully do a little better than that going into FY19.
And what does that mean, adjusting priorities? Does that mean eliminating other agencies? What does that mean?
Trying to level things across the board. Over the last two or three years, basically K-12 education has been held harmless in budget reductions and the process. And we've shifted from that a little bit to recognize the fact that there are stress in other areas of the budget.
Okay, you hear from the music. Our time is up. Thank you very much, Representative Gary Worthen, Senator Rob Hoke, Steve Eckley, and Scott Peters. We appreciate it. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon with help from Natalia Reyes. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow.